Hello, you have reached the Free Energy Now radio show. This is a weekly show that we started last week. It will be ongoing, talking about clean, green, renewable, affordable, reliable, safe energy solutions that are on the cutting edge, both available now and coming down the pike. Today with us, we have Mark Goldies. He's the CEO of Magnet Power, Inc. Mark, how are you doing?
Okay. Glad to be on board.
Nice to have you. We had a little slow start there. We apologize to anyone who tuned in right at the top of the hour. Mark has been on our radar for a long time. When I say hour, I'm talking about the New Energy Congress, of which I'm a part. We've been organized since September of last year. And also, I'm wearing another hat when I say hour, and that is the PES Network, which is a news and directory service. We keep our ear to the ground to see what's going on in the clean, green, affordable energy sector. And Mark Goldies has been on that radar from the beginning. And even before I started doing news and directory stuff, I was involved in working on helping to bring a magnet motor technology to market. And I actually met Mark back then. So we go back quite a ways, Mark, you and I do.
Yes, we do.
It's been, what, 4 years or so?
Oh, at least that.
Yeah. And so we've had a lot of phone conversations. We never met each other in person, but we've had a lot of email and phone back and forth. You've sent us press releases. We've published those, or we've linked to elsewhere where they've been published in some cases. You're very prolific. You're one of the most communicative people out there in terms of telling people what's going on and kind of the new developments. And most recently, you've kind of opened things up quite a bit in publishing the patent application that you submitted and is still under review by the U.S. Patent Office.
Right.
So a lot of great developments. Let's start by trying to get a thumbnail overview of what it is you have, and then maybe we can go into a little more detail. But tell us, first of all, what is Magnet Power, Inc., and what is it that you are going to be bringing forward?
Well, Magnetic Power, Inc. was originated in 1984 when Robert Forward, who was then a physicist at Hughes Aircraft, published a paper in perhaps the most prestigious of all the physics journals, Physical Review, suggesting that we could get electricity from space, from what scientists generally call zero-point energy. And that same year, an inventor approached us and said he thought he could create a magnetic device which would produce electricity with no apparent input, and that he'd spent his whole life in magnetics. His name was Floyd Sweet. His nickname was Sparky. And so we gave him some help, and he then did a lot of work for quite a long time. We had a project manager in Southern California. We gave him a couple of New Zealand engineers who were visiting in the United States that we supported to help him. And one day he picked up the phone and said, "Mark, you better fly down here and let me show you what I'm doing. I'm lighting the small tail light from an automobile, and I think you'll find it very interesting." So I got on an airplane from Northern California and flew down to Southern California and drove over to his laboratory, which was in his house. And there was a small light bulb from a tail lamp of an ordinary passenger car, and it was lit brightly, and all he had was a 9-volt battery feeding the system. And it was a small system. It would fit in a shoebox. And that was very interesting, and he showed me, measured the power input and the power output, and it was clearly a substantial little energy gain, and that got us very excited. And
well,
so,
when you say energy gain, give us a little feel, because you're
well,
talking
we,
about 9 volts.
The 9-volt battery, of course, can only produce a relatively small amount of power, and I can't tell you what the output of that first system was. But about 2 weeks later, he called me again and said, "Fly down again. I've got something burning two bulbs now and a small motor turning." And at that point, when I flew down, I do remember that it was had an output of 73 watts. And there was no way that that could have been coming from the 9-volt battery. And so that was the beginning of magnetic power. We had incorporated a short time before, and Magnetic Power Incorporated is a California corporation. And we then began looking at, you know, how do we move this kind of technology into the marketplace? And from then to now, we've looked at dozens and dozens of different prototypes, some of them here in our own laboratories and some of them where the inventors live. And essentially, until 4 years ago, none of them looked as though they could really become commercial. And at that point, we ran into an inventor who we work with now and who's a full-time employee of the company. And the patent that's pending was the work of Graham Gundersen. And Graham had first built a couple of rotary machines, which he called dragless generators, because they had found a way, he had found a way, to make generators which overcame Lenz's law. Now, for people who don't have background in electrical engineering or motors, they may not be aware that whenever you have a motor that rotates, there's a very strong opposing force, and it's known technically as Lenz's law. And this was the first time we'd ever seen any device that seemed to find a way to harness Lenz's law instead of fighting it. And so that was very intriguing, and we began supporting what he was doing, and then he came up with something rather ingenious. He said, I believe that when Tesla, Nikola Tesla, who died, of course, in the early 40s and who contributed alternating current, which is the backbone of all of the society's electricity everywhere in the world, Tesla had patented the rotating magnetic field way back in the 1880s. And that, of course, is still used by all motors and generators. And he said, you know, I can rotate the magnetic field electronically a lot faster than anyone could mechanically. And I think I'm going to be able to do that. So we said, sure, let's see what happens. And the result of that was in December of 2004, he had a very small prototype that was driven by a signal generator, very low power, and it had an output of more than 100 times the input, which was phenomenal. And even though the power was well under 1 watt, nonetheless, we immediately said, let's get a patent filed. And that's how the patent began. It's now been published 18 months from the date of filing. Patents are routinely published unless you don't plan to patent outside of the country that you live in. And since we expect this patent will be filed everywhere in the world, we did indeed file a patent. And that patent now, the application now reveals a good deal about the machine, although there's much more about it that we're learning all the time. And practical versions of it will not emerge from what people see in the patent application that's been published. Practical versions depend on things that aren't there that will be in amendments and what are called continuations in part. But basically, when the final patent issues, they'll reveal exactly how anybody skilled in the art, as it said, can reproduce this machine.
So it is a true utility patent with a working prototype. How is the prototype proceeding in terms of having something that you can put on the desk at the patent office and satisfy their requirements?
Well, we're now in the process of building more than 20 new prototypes, and those will give us the data we need to produce a pre-production prototype of a demonstration device. And the demonstration device is a unit that will fit in a shoebox, or roughly that, sit on a desk, and light some LEDs and turn a small fan. And
let's back up for a second, and for some of the audience who might not be aware of what pre-production prototype means, could you just...
Sure. What that means is a prototype that we can give to a manufacturer who licenses the patent so that they can get ready to look at how to make these machines on a mass production basis.
So it's basically something that is ready to hit the copy button a bunch of times. You've worked out the bugs, and it's basically ready to go. Is that correct?
Right. And essentially, when that's done, then the manufacturer has to order parts, and a lot of the pieces of these things will take some time to fabricate and be in the manufacturer's own factory. But once that's achieved, sometime next year, these demonstration devices will undoubtedly be sold by every company that licenses them for production. And they will be, the prices will be determined by those companies. We're just a licensing firm, and they'll pay a royalty to our company on every one that they make.
Another clarification, too, because there's a little bit of confusion that can arise here when you talk about pre-production prototype for a demonstration device. Strategically, if I understand right, rather than come forward with a product that is an application that you can run a car or run an appliance, or you're first going to come forward with a device that is purely designed to prove that this can work. Is that
right.
Correct?
And the reason for that is that every scientist or engineer knows that the textbook says you can't do this. And so it's an extraordinarily difficult thing for people trained in the sciences or who have engineering background to believe that such machines are possible. Now, until they see it sitting on their desk and running, and it's very clear that there's no battery, and that there's a very clear explanation of how and why it works, engineers and scientists are going to say this cannot be real. And we get that reaction all the time, as does everybody else who's doing similar work anywhere in the world. And so the first product is designed to allow people to see that, in fact, this is real, and it does represent new science. And it's interesting because if you go back, way back in 1874, an American inventor in Pennsylvania patented a machine that had moving parts and tapped this same energy source. And essentially in 1879, Harper's Magazine, which already existed at that point, did a big article on him, which is linked to the chronology in our website. His name was Gary, Wesley Gary. And Wesley Gary was visited by professors from Harvard and MIT, and everybody agreed he had really done it. But the textbooks all the way back then already said you can't do this. And so there wasn't enough investor support, even though at the end of the article in Harper's it said, perhaps one day this will run a locomotive. And 6 years later, the four-wheeled automobile was invented. So one of the great ironies is that we probably never needed oil to run our cars. But of course, since everybody in science accepted the dogma that said you can't do this, the result was that investors were frightened away, as they usually are. And the consequence of that is the machine never went anywhere, even though it had American and Canadian patents. And then some years later, decades later, in 1925, a German inventor named Hans Kohler demonstrated a small machine without moving parts that did this, converted the same source of energy, and produced, if I recall, about 10 watts of electricity. And that machine was probably what resulted in Werner Heisenberg, a rather famous Nobel Prize physicist in his day, stating that we could, in fact, get electricity, in his opinion, from magnetism. And basically, Kohler continued to work on what he was trying to do until in 1937, he had a different design which produced 6,000 watts of electricity, enough to recharge the batteries of, say, a submarine. And so Hitler's Admiralty, the Nazi Navy, then supported him all through the rest of World War II. And the Allies, who probably didn't know what the secret project was, targeted his laboratory shortly before the war ended and destroyed it. But he survived. And in 1946, British intelligence did a report which clearly showed that professors in Germany had visited his work and agreed that it was real. And the British tried to recreate the machine with him. And they got some limited success. But as we now know, the pieces that were done in England, the metals that were used, the solder that was used, these were very different than what was available in Nazi Germany. Solder in Nazi Germany, as an example, was high silver content, which was not true in England. And the iron that he used was probably very, very pure iron, as is typical of German factories and isn't particularly typical in England. And so the machine did a little bit of demonstrating that it was real, but it basically didn't do the 6 kilowatts that it had done in Germany. However, that report, which was classified when it was issued, at least part of it, 30-some-odd pages of it, were declassified in 1979. And that's now all over the web. Anybody who enters the name Hans Kohler on the web in Google or any other search engine will bring up the British report, or at least the parts of it that have so far been made public.
And that's spelled K-O-H-L-E-R?
No, it's C-O-L-E-R. And that's one possible spelling. Obviously, it's transliterated from German, and so you can spell it a number of ways. But the normal spelling is C-O-L-E-R. That's how the British intelligence people spelled it. And so anyone who puts that into Google, Hans Kohler, is going to bring up a 30-some-odd page, at least extract, if not the complete report. We don't think it's the complete report. There's some indication that the report was probably 200 pages or more, and nobody has seen or been able to find the remainder of it, and maybe one day that'll surface. Typically, a lot of those old classified reports are no longer around, and since they usually made several copies, one of them will probably pop up someday when nobody expects it. But the machine is being reproduced, or at least their attempts at being reproducing it, in one of our own national laboratories. Since it's unofficial and informal, I can't say which one. It's also being reproduced, or an attempt is being made to reproduce it, at a university in London. And it also is being attempted by a physicist who used to be on the faculty of a University of California campus, and by a physicist in Latin America. So essentially, the machine is probably one of these days going to be reproduced successfully. But there again, that was a solid-state device. It was very clear that the energy was from a new source. He called it space energy, and he recognized that he had overturned a lot of what physicists believe. But oil was cheap, and the world wasn't worried about energy in those days. And so nothing much ever happened with that machine. And we have a page on our website, magneticpowerinc.com, that challenges any university anywhere to try to reproduce the machine, and any national laboratory anywhere. And we'll supply a report done by our lab in the UK that shows what we think was the key to how it worked. And of course, it was a primitive machine compared to the designs that are being developed now, but it clearly shows that this is real science, and these demonstration devices will make that extraordinarily clear. And then once we've got those to where we want them as pre-production prototypes, we'll proceed to do what will amount to 1 kilowatt units, which will probably be made up of several of these magnetic power modules, as we call them. And essentially, the output will be 1 kilowatt. And both of these, the demo devices and the 1 kilowatt modules, will be self-powered in the sense that they are tapping this energy from space, which is often called zero-point energy. When it's converted magnetically, we think it's more accurate to call it virtual photon flux. But whatever it's called, it's inexhaustible, and there are huge quantities of it. Richard Feynman, the Nobel laureate before he died, once said that if you could liberate all the zero-point energy in the volume of a coffee cup, you could evaporate the oceans of the Earth. And another scientist, Hal Puthoff, has said that if our civilization ran on it, it would be like dipping a thimble into the ocean. In other words, this is everywhere in space. There's huge amounts of it. And before World War II, it was considered that it couldn't be real because nobody had ever tapped it in any way. And the numbers were so immense, even larger in density than nuclear power, that the scientists thought it must be virtual. It must just be a convenient mathematical tool to help solve certain equations in quantum mechanics. But after the war in 1947, a Dutch physicist named Casimir, who died about 4 years ago, Casimir noticed that when he took two very smooth plates of non-magnetic metal, and they got very close to one another, they suddenly snapped together as though they were magnets. And he was mystified, and the whole physics community had 10 years of debate as to what in the world could be causing that. And finally, it was concluded that it must be that zero-point energy was real. And that meant, of course, that there was huge energy available, but they thought, well, you know, you can just tap little tiny bits of it, until the paper appeared that I mentioned earlier by Robert Forward, who also died about the same time, and who was a physicist at Hughes Aircraft at the time, and who said, I think we can get electricity from this. And as it turns out, he was right.
So your demonstration device is basically putting into action what these various scientists that you've mentioned, and I imagine this is just a sampling of what is available that could be mentioned, and your demonstration device is basically saying, here is a device you can buy that will show this working. Now, let's talk about that demonstration device. How big is it going to be? Is it going to be see-through?
Well, I say it's about, our guess at the moment is it'll be about the size of a shoebox. We can't be precisely certain yet till we get a little further in the 20-some-odd prototypes we're putting together now. But essentially, let's say it's that size and that it's lighting a few LEDs and it spins a small fan. And we'll bring the terminals out at whatever power it produces, which won't be much. But it may very well be that people will use it to run transistor radios of type that doesn't require much power or other things, just to prove to themselves that this is real and that the power that's generated is available to do real work with real things and doesn't disappear. And I mention that because there are people...
This is going to be solid state?
Yes. These are all these devices at the moment look like our early demonstration devices will be solid state. I might mention we have a full-time laboratory in Florida that's producing rotary machines, and those too will be demonstration devices, and so we'll have both kinds. But at the moment, it appears as though the solid state devices will be in the market first.
Okay. And now let's talk about, is it going to be see-through? How much is it going to cost?
Well, we don't know what it's going to cost because there's nothing inherently expensive. And these early machines will be brought to a quality standard typical of, say, items that appear in the Sharper Image catalog. And the reason for that is that they're likely to be bought by a lot of schools and colleges and universities and laboratories all over the place. And so they'll be made to a fairly high standard. We don't know yet what manufacturers will charge. That's up to them. And as competition appears from other manufacturers, the prices will vary all over the world. But over time, toys will start being made, both rotary and solid state, that demonstrate this very clearly. And the toys, of course, will be less expensive than these rather nice, elegant demonstration devices. And those will be used by toy manufacturers to drive other things that they make. No batteries required. And there are people who think, well, the magnets will run down. But permanent magnets are really pretty permanent. In terms of a human lifetime, if they're used in the point in their design curve where they're designed to be used, they don't run down. They'll just keep doing what they're doing, and essentially Over a very much longer period of time, 1-2% of the energy will in fact gradually not be there, but that's far, far longer than a human lifetime.
In terms of the size and energy density of this device, you talked about possibly combining some of these together into a power module to make them
right.
A kilowatt.
The first kilowatt modules might be the size of a microwave oven, and they're stackable. That is, one nice thing about modules is you can put them together. Here in California, solar cells, when they're used on a home, photovoltaic cells, normally amount to a little under 4 kilowatts. That's the average in California. And so if you had four of these 1-kilowatt modules, you could replace photovoltaic cells in the same way that you use the cells in a home. And you don't have to go on the roof. They can be anywhere that makes sense to put them. And essentially, they are likely to be very long-lived. Solar cells, of course, occasionally have to be cleaned. These things are solid state, and if they're made to a high standard, they shouldn't require much maintenance any more than any good solid state device requires in this day and age. So they basically will be capable of being used for home power. Ultimately, they'll be used to power individual appliances. And this design is only one of a total of a half dozen solid state designs that the company is working with. The others haven't had patents filed yet, but they will shortly. And rotary machines, the same quantity, at least a half dozen designs. And so there'll be lots of different kinds of machines, all doing the same things, just like you have car engines. There are many, many, many varieties of car engines. They all run your car. And so these machines will all do the same thing, but some of them will have a shaft and be rotating, and others will just be solid state. And there will be different applications that these different devices will have. For example, we'll want to be able to shrink them to replace engines in an automobile. The first attempt to use them in an automobile might be to take the 1-kilowatt module and have that replace the plug-in power that's used on hybrids that are being converted today. As you know, at least two groups, one nonprofit in Palo Alto, California, another commercial in Southern California, are converting Prius hybrids to run on plug-in power, where they put a whole bunch of lithium-ion batteries into the car, and then they recharge those overnight by plugging into the wall socket. Well, there's nothing to say we can't remove that plug-in and substitute our 1-kilowatt unit, because that's typically what is taken from the wall socket. And consequently, we now can show automobile manufacturers that you can do all your local driving without the need for any fuel and without anything that has to be charged by plugging into a wall. And it will be transparent to any manufacturer of automobiles that one day we can make those units large enough to replace engines. And if we have enough capital, as we expect to have, then the assumption is that we'll be able to do that in a couple of years. And by 2010, if all goes well, cars may be coming off of assembly lines from different companies all over the world that no longer require any engine at all. They now have magnetic power, and they basically don't have to plug in. And where everybody's been saying, who killed the electric car in the movie that just came out, the electric car may rise from the ashes, and all automobiles produced at that point are likely to be electric, because who would want to buy a car that needs fuel if you can drive without it?
You're saying 2 years out we could see that vision become a reality?
On a prototype basis, and then by 2010, which is still 4 years out, some manufacturers that can really do things in a hurry may well be able to start producing cars.
Let's pause for a second. If Don happens to be listening in, the producer, we do like to have a little plug-in show at the bottom of the hour with Xenia talking about some practical tips. If he can bring her in, We'll just wait for that cue, but we'll go ahead and continue our dialogue until we get that cue. Let's talk about practicality in terms of nuts and bolts of what... practicality is not the right word. Let's talk about realism. In this field of alternative energy, there are a lot of claims that float around. You're talking about several different iterations and prototype work that you've done. If I were to drive to California or fly to California today and show up on your doorstep wanting to do a license or something, what would you be showing me?
Well, here I'd be showing you our superconductor laboratory, because that's the work that's done here in California. And I would be showing you photographs of the things that are done in the laboratory in Washington State and the laboratory in Florida and in our laboratory in the UK. And we now have a laboratory in Mexico, and we have another one that started working with us in Kansas and another one in Latin America. And so we have people working in a way that today is commonplace, where we can link them. And we don't try so far, since we haven't had a lot of capital, to bring them all into one place. And in fact, we probably never will do that. But we gradually will centralize a lot of the work here in Sebastopol, California, because it's a very nice place to do it.
And so back to the question, if somebody with the desire to license a technology were to say, what do you have available, and wanted to see some proof of concept?
Well, we would then say, if you sign a non-disclosure, which all of them do, and we are talking to some companies already, then you're welcome to go to our laboratories in this country and see, in the case of the Florida laboratory, they can see over-unity rotary devices right now. Those are being prepared for some tests that will be happening, hopefully, before the end of the summer. And those devices don't yet self-power, although later on we expect that they will. But they do demonstrate that there's more output than input. And essentially, they also show that the work can be done with several different approaches and several different designs.
So how many iterations do they have there?
Well, we have partly built machines, and then we have completed machines. And at the moment, we have a couple of machines that are reasonably complete. We always have at least one that we can show working. And there are, again, a half dozen designs under construction in each laboratory.
Do you have any places where somebody could see one of these solid-state versions?
We're not yet. We basically do bring people to that laboratory, but at the moment we've just moved another laboratory into it, and there's a huge amount of stuff. And the fellow who's running the lab has had a health problem develop, nothing very serious, but enough that we're just not bringing people to that laboratory at the moment. But within a month or so, that'll be open to companies that are interested in licensing and to substantial investors, again, signing non-disclosures. They'll be able to visit both labs.
You were talking about having these demonstration prototypes available by the end of 2006. Are you still on track for that?
I hope so. That's largely determined by the amount of working capital. The irony of all of this is that because the work violates what scientists believe, the money available, ever since the dot-com crash, has been horrendously small for all advanced high-tech companies without revenue. And since we don't have revenue either in the parent company, Magnetic Power Incorporated, or in our 51% owned subsidiary, Room Temperature Superconductors Incorporated, without revenues, money doesn't flow in the way that it does once a company has revenue. And so a lot of the speed with which we achieve what we're trying to do is determined by what are called angel investors. These are people who have to be what are called accredited investors. That is, they have to be able to afford to lose money in a high-risk investment, because these things are still high-risk investments. And basically, They're required by law to have a net worth of at least $1 million. That includes homes and cars. And the alternative is to have an income of $200,000 or more. And so that limits the people who can dive in to put money into this. And essentially, we've raised to this point a little over $7.6 million from angel investors. And of that, $5 million was for our superconductor subsidiary, because in that work, the proof is no longer in question. That was reproduced initially during the Cold War at the Yaffe Institute. The work originated in the Soviet Union, and essentially we brought it all to the United States when the Cold War ended and we learned about it. But the Yaffe Institute was famous in this country all through the Cold War among scientists, and a Yaffe team reproduced this work, which was originally done at an institute of what was then the Soviet Academy, is now called the Russian Academy of Sciences in Moscow. And they concluded in papers that are now available in English that these polymer materials, these plastics, were capable of zero resistance, had in fact no resistance at all. And then the work was reproduced at the Bar-Ilan University in Israel, and there they did magnetic tests, because superconductors often stop superconducting at high magnetic fields. And the limit of their equipment was 9 Tesla, which is a mighty high magnetic field. And they were still superconducting like crazy. And then we had 4 contracts with the Department of Defense, 2 with the Air Force, a Phase 1 and a Phase 2 Small Business Innovation Research contract. And the Air Force did its own tests. And more recently, they went to a small company and said, you reproduce this and test it. And that was successful. And that company is headed by a scientist who's on our scientific advisory council, and who, when he first came here, with our first Air Force contract officer, sat down at our conference table and said, of course, I've been following this work for many years. And we looked at him like he'd come off the moon. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, he said, you know, I used to be at Los Alamos for 7 years, and one day I got a phone call from Washington, and they asked me to fly in, and they took me into a copper-lined room and handed me a copy of the first Air Force intelligence translation of this Soviet work. And I've been the guy who monitors it for the United States government ever since. Well, his name is Matt Aldissi, and Dr. Aldissi is the scientist who convenes the International Conference on Conducting Polymers, Conducting Plastics, every year. And essentially, we were very pleased that the Air Force went to his company and asked him to reproduce these materials, which he did. And then what used to be called the Ballistic Missile Defense Organization gave us a couple of contracts. And those were also successful. So we did get 4 federal contracts on that work. And since Magnetic Power Incorporated still owns 51% of that subsidiary, that gives investors a hedge with well-proven technology, even though most scientists in superconductivity would say, oh, it can't be possible that you've got plastic polymers, as it were, that are conducting electricity like a superconductor. These materials conduct at least 100,000 times better than gold, silver, or copper. And copper, of course, is now at an all-time high in price. And so making plastic wire out of these materials will be very exciting. And that's an $18 million 3-year program, which we're now hoping will begin before the end of this year. And essentially, that we think will be one big advantage of driving the price of copper down a bit, as well as providing a much better material, not only for everything made with copper wire, but also for our own generators.
So this is a sister project that is another technology that came along after you started on the with Sparky Sweet and whatnot way back in 84.
That's right. We incorporated that company. We went to Moscow in late 92, and we incorporated that firm in 93. And essentially, we found that it was very much easier to attract money to that than it was for this strange new science that people didn't believe.
Yeah, it's not as far out on the limb.
Exactly. And so we were very pleased to find that we could continue looking for the right magnetic systems, which, as I say, we didn't find the really promising stuff until less than 4 years ago. And so from 1984 until today, the work in magnetic energy has had just over 2.6 million of the 7.6 million plus that we've raised. And that's a mighty small budget. I mean, to give you the contrast, the world has spent hundreds of billions of dollars on hot fusion, which has not to this day achieved over unity, that is, more output than input. And yet we've repeatedly achieved that with magnetic systems, and we've done it on a shoestring, on virtually no money. And it's certainly the case that we could do wonders if we had a lot of money. At one time, I was what was called a senior director of an Air Force radar station in Germany that used to control the NATO Carter that American aircraft flew up and back to Berlin. And radar stations, as everybody knows, never shut down. The way they do that is they have four teams and four complete crews. And so we can do the same thing if we had enough money with four teams of technicians and engineers working around the clock to make this stuff available faster. And we hope to do that. And we are beginning to get interest at large enough scale of capital that looks promising. The problem is working capital. The problem is the small investors, the modest amounts of money that come in that keep it all going. And that's a tough problem. We've never found an easy answer to that. Before the dot-com crash, the superconductor work used to attract a solid $100,000 a month in angel money very easily. But once dot-com crash came along, all high-tech companies without revenue suddenly found that not only didn't angels want to invest and venture capital groups didn't want to invest, but there was nothing that would provide any kind of help that made any sense. And it's just beginning to change. It's just starting again. And now that the country so desperately needs to get off of oil and off of fossil fuels in general, and everyone can see that peak oil either has occurred or may be about to occur, we have an enormous problem. And this has got to be, if not the most exciting, one of the most exciting technologies that could change the ball game. And you know, when Hitler declared war on the United States, when Pearl Harbor was attacked, we were a little curious as to why, because, you know, there's nothing that had happened to Germany per se. And eventually we discovered that the reason was that Hitler was saying to his people, well, what can the United States do to us? But 36 months later, they had 2,000 bomber raids as a daily occurrence over Germany because American industry geared up and worked around the clock. Well, that's what's needed now to bring oil prices down, to remove our dependency on the Middle East, to begin to reverse global warming. And all of that can be done with magnetic systems. They are inherently safe. They're inherently simple. They're inherently cost-effective. And consequently, they hold out an enormous beacon of light in a time in which people are so discouraged about the energy scene. And we would love to have many more of them. Contact us at magneticpower@gmail.com. That's the best email address. I'll repeat that, magneticpower@gmail.com. And if people are interested in helping and they're not accredited investors, the first item on our website is by our affiliated nonprofit, ESOP Institute. And they're welcome to lend money to the Institute instead of to the company. If they lend it to the company, we have a terrifically attractive incentive deal at the moment that they're welcome to participate in until large money starts to flow into the program.
I'd like to ask a question that I've been curious about for quite some time. You know, I know several people who have shown up on your doorstep and have seen some of your stuff and have worked quite closely with you, much more closely than I have. And I get very positive reviews from those people.
Thank you.
They just can't say enough good about what you have and how viable and feasible it is. Let me ask you the question. In the 20 years that you've been working on this, you know, you're talking about Sparky Sweet. He's a pillar and a legend in the field of free energy. And I today is the first time, I guess, it's dawning on me that you actually had interaction with him in the early days.
Well, we stopped interacting with him when we discovered that there were some things that bothered us. One is we asked him to put the machine in a Faraday cage, and he refused. The second is we asked him to apply for a patent, and he refused. So we pulled away from Sparky. And for a long time, we weren't sure if there might have been an element of fraud. But as the work has gone forward in our Washington State Laboratory, we've discovered that what he probably had done is buy some surplus magnets. And the magnets were made of barium ferrite. And maybe 1 in 100, or maybe less often than that, would operate in the kind of circuit he was putting together. And we discovered that he himself couldn't reproduce his own machine. And he was very nervous about people trying to really evaluate it, because that was one of the problems. So we pulled away from Sparky way back, and essentially it didn't really understand what was going on until we found that these occasional magnets would do what he was claiming was happening.
So my question is, in the last 20 years, could you give us a ballpark idea of how many people have personally witnessed over-unity per the systems that you have seen in an over-unity scenario that are
I would say about a dozen in all. There haven't been a lot of people. The nice thing is that the people who've been there recently are scientists and engineers, and they know how to measure. And one of them, who came from another country and flew over here a great distance when he got into our Florida laboratory, halfway through seeing the measurements, he said, "I've got to tell you, to this point, I never believed that over-unity was possible. Now I believe it."
Mm-hmm. So a dozen people in 20 years?
Well, we haven't started showing this stuff until outside of our own internal group until very recently. It's only this year that we've been showing it to people, because it's only this year that it's gone far enough that we've been willing to do that.
When somebody comes to you and is interested in plunking down some money in one way or another, do you typically show them some stuff?
If they're six-figure investors, meaning mm-hmm. if they're putting in $100,000 or more, they're welcome to visit a laboratory. At the moment, the open lab is in Florida, but in a month or so, both labs will be open again. The only problem with that is it stops all the work. And so I'm not really eager to have people parading through the labs at the cost of having everything stop while we're so underfunded that we don't have other people that can keep going. What's happening is that the lab loses a day of work whenever we have a visitor. And this work is so urgent that that's really something we have to be cautious about doing. But that's the only reason. There's no real problem otherwise.
So on smaller amounts,
here and see photographs. They can see test data with a signed non-disclosure. We can give them, you know, the measurements that we've taken. We can give them theoretical explanations of how this all works. We can allow them to see things that are still confidential. But basically, visitors to the laboratory have to be able to do at least a $100,000 investment if we're going to stop the work for a day.
Mm-hmm. Let's wind forward 6 months or 9 months, however long it's going to take to, you, and let's say your demonstration devices are now in the market. If I want to get one, I can buy one. from a university or whatever the case may
be. No, they'd be from manufacturers and maybe even the Sharper Image if they decide a manufacturer wants to work with them and sell them that way. The manufacturers will determine how they're sold.
Right, so the question is this. You now have the availability of a significant number of prototypes or demonstration devices that people can view to see proof of concept, and people's minds are going to start opening up. Do you see it as being somewhat of a breaking the dam phenomena where the finger has been in the dike?
I think you're exactly right. I think at that point there will be an enormous change, and the reason is that the little known aspects of global warming, such as the release of methane in the Arctic, could eliminate all human life on Earth by 2050, if not before. Now, that's not 50 years ahead of us. And there are many scientists who believe we only have 10 years to turn it around, and some who've told me, a physicist was here this week who said we only have 5 years, in his opinion. And so there's an enormous need for very, very rapid implementation of this technology, and not only our technology. Normally, as a commercial firm, we would be very loath to cheer on our competitors. But we're an affiliate of a nonprofit, which is primarily concerned with education. And we are consequently very, very much encouraging every conceivable technology that could help. And we think all of them ought to be very generously funded to see what we can do to eliminate the need for fossil fuels, which are going to kill our children and our grandchildren. And I don't think there's anybody alive on the planet that wouldn't like to avoid that. So that's, to me, an overwhelming concern. And I would think that there'd be lots of people who, if they really understand that, and if they look at our website, magneticpowerinc.com, they'll find some very complete information that will lead them to even more complete explanations as to why that danger is so imminent. And essentially, this work is as urgent as anything that exists on the planet, and breaking the dam is why we decided let's do demo devices so that we can have a massive change. Again, all our competitors are welcome. We'd like them all out there to do everything they can to bring new energies forward that can take automobiles to where we no longer burn fuel, can stop the use of fossil fuel, and get us off of nuclear power, which is another huge problem that people are starting to cheer on again. And they don't need it. This stuff is cheap, it's fast to produce. Nuclear is inherently expensive and slow to produce. So we're looking at something that has a huge need that most people are unaware of. And if we can contribute to that, to solving that problem or contributing to the solution, that's what we started out to do when we founded the nonprofit all the way back in 1973.
Now, would you ever conceive that in that process that you would actually, quote-unquote, open source the core technologies, just allowing
Once the patents are out there, then there will be licensees everywhere, and we're following to some extent, although we may change it to a bit, the biotech model of getting as many small companies as well as large companies everywhere in the world to produce this technology as fast as they can. And the real problem, once the stuff is, the patent is issued on any technology, anybody can build it. But you do have to pay royalties. You do have to contact us, and there has to be a royalty, and those will be modest. We're not trying to do anything more than push this stuff out as fast as humanly possible.
Okay, so in terms of having a set of plans that are clearly stated where I could go buy off-the-shelf components and put them together and run one of these things, build one to run my home.
There'll probably be kits available to do that from some of the licensees, because it's a lucrative market. I mean, one of the interesting things is the computer revolution generated a tremendous amount of new business in the United States. Energy is the backbone of the world economy. It dwarfs what the computer revolution did. And consequently, Everything like that is likely to happen to make things as easy as they can be for anybody who wants to build their own.
Well, Mark, we've had a great hour. I appreciate the time that you've put in the 20 years and in this last hour to tell us all about it. You can find out more about him at
MagneticPowerInc.com or write to us at MagneticPower@gmail.com.
And join us every day at FreeEnergyNews.com. We have a family of four major websites, and we include a feature page on Mark Goldie's technology. Thanks again for joining us, and come again next week for Free Energy Now.
Thanks so much, Sterling. Bye-bye.
Bye.